This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading research medical schools. Icon Mount Sinai is the academic arm of the 8-hospital Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. It's consistently among the top recipients of NIH funding. Researchers at Icon Mount Sinai have made breakthrough discoveries in many fields vital to advancing the health of patients, including cancer, COVID and long COVID, cardiology, neuroscience, and artificial intelligence. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. You listen to us to hear about new discoveries in science, but did you know we're a part of the American Association for the Advancement of Science? AAAS is a nonprofit publisher and a science society. When you join AAAS, you help support our mission to advance science for the benefit of all. Become a AAAS member at the silver level or above to receive a year's subscription to science and an exclusive gift. Join today by visiting AAAS.org/join. That's AAAS.org/join. This is the Science Podcast for March 8th, 2024. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up this week, we hear from online news editor Mike Price about a large genome sequencing project in India that reveals past migrations in the region and a unique intermixing with Neanderthals in ancient times. Next on the show, producer Kevin McLean talks with researcher Matthew Tierney about how vitamin A and stem cells work together to heal wounds. This week, online news editor Mike Price wrote about the largest genome project from India so far and what it reveals about ancient migrations in this region and Neanderthal mixing back in the day. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Sarah. Good to be here.
Yeah. So I had no idea that the intricacies of Neanderthal mixing around the different regions of the world. Like, I knew it happened in Europe, and I think that's because European genomes were sequenced really early and there are sites that have Neanderthal evidence of their settlement there, but it's global, right? Everybody's got a little bit of Neanderthal DNA.
Just about all non-Africans have a little bit of Neanderthal DNA, yes. And even some African populations too, from things like back migration. And there's a lot of puzzles involved in where the people of the world have gotten our Neanderthal genes from.
So how is the population in modern day India, how is their Neanderthal ancestry different than what we've seen in Europe so far?
So one of the things that they found in this most recent study is that while the Indian populations have about the same percentage of Neanderthal ancestry as other non-Africans, so that's about 1% to 2% of an individual's genes were inherited from a Neanderthal ancestor, the population-wide assortment of Neanderthal DNA is much more varied in India than it is in any other population that they've looked at so far.
They just have a lot more of the Neanderthal genome spread throughout their population in little fragments.
That's exactly right. You can reconstruct about 90% of the known Neanderthal genome from genomes within modern day Indians. That means that you could put together most of the Neanderthal genome from the bits and fragments that are scattered throughout Indian populations. And then also something kind of interesting is that there are far more population-specific genomic sequences in India than anywhere else. So what that means is there are unique Neanderthal sequences found in populations in India that aren't found anywhere else. And there are more of those in India than in any other population that they've looked at.
Does that suggest there's some selective pressure going on? There's some, you know, environmental factors that allowed those sequences to remain in the genomes of those populations?
I asked some experts that question, and unfortunately, the answer is they don't know yet.
Too soon to tell. Okay.
Yeah. Too soon to tell is the stock answer. And then unfortunately, in this case, it is true.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to determine whether or not these genes carry a selective advantage. In a lot of cases, they're not even necessarily sure what the functional significance of these genes is.
But this has been shown in other populations that they have something that was inherited from Neanderthal ancestors, and it has an adaptive advantage because of the unique circumstances that the people live in.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And then some of the people that I talked to for this story did mention that there's a decent shot that some of these genes probably carry immune advantages that would have helped fight off diseases, and those advantages would have been inherited from Neanderthal ancestors. But this is all work to be carried out in the future to see whether or not that adaptive signal actually is present and strong and comes through clearly in these genes.
Getting to the study itself, we just jumped right into the admixture pass, but we should also, it also reveals something about migrations in this area, because you got to remember, people all started in Africa and they got to where they are now over some period of time. And it's very complicated and it's a very interesting question that there's all different ways of addressing, but one is to look at the genetic structure of the modern day population and ancient populations and see where everybody relates through time. So what did this new kind of much larger effort at sequencing genomes in India tell us about where people historically came from?
A few years ago, a research team led by David Reich and Priya Morjani put out a couple studies looking at ancient genomes from throughout Eurasia. And by reconstructing those ancient genomes and looking at how they related to modern day populations in South Asia, they had found that there were three main sources of ancestry that form the backbone of modern day Indians. There was and sort of an indigenous South Asian population of what would have been hunter-gatherers that arrived in South Asia many tens of thousands of years ago. At some point, that population mixed with a group of Iranian farmers. They were able to find that Iranian-related ancestry that entered into the Indian population around 5,000 to 3,000 BCE. And then towards the tail end of that, there was this other pulse of migration from Eurasian steppe herders. These would have been the Yamnaya herders that herded things like cattle and goats and sheep and brought in that other level of animal domestication into the population.
That's the picture that came to the researchers who did this study. They knew from the ancient DNA evidence this kind of mix was there. But what does the new study of all these modern genomes give us?
The primary thing that this new study did was it allowed us to gain a little bit more insight into the Iranian ancestry part of this puzzle. Digging more deeply into modern populations, and they had about 2,700 genomes represented from modern populations across a whole variety of geographic locations and linguistic groups and castes and religions. By looking for this Iranian ancestry and mapping it back onto ancient genomes that they've looked at in the past, they were able to get a finer detailed look at where exactly this Iranian ancestry originated. The strongest signal that they found came from this remote outpost near what is today northwestern Tajikistan called Sarazm. And Sarazm, back in the day, 5,000 BC-ish, was a trading outpost that was not quite in the mountains, not quite in the plains, not quite in the steppes, but it was sort of this place where all of those things would have come together. And so it would have made it a natural place for traders and travelers from all these different regions from Eurasia to meet up and exchange goods. And what they found was is that the ancient Iranian ancestry that had been found in Sarazm was the closest match for the Iranian-related ancestry present in modern-day Indians. So what it seems like is that Sarazm was the place that this pulse of Iranian ancestry originated and then came down into South Asia. But what's also kind of cool and neat to see is that you can also see Indian ancestry in individuals that were present in Sarazm as well. What that means is it wasn't just a one-way street. You had people from South Asia going up into Sarazm and trading their own goods more than likely. And so it wasn't just a one-way street of migration. It just sort of reveals how interconnected the ancient world was.
So there's another outstanding question that is addressed in your story. And this is about the effects of the Toba supervolcano eruption. This was a catastrophic event about 74,000 years ago in what is now Indonesia. And it was so big that some people think this caused a bottleneck for all of humanity, and we went down to a very small number of people and then had to repopulate the Earth from there. But that's not a done deal. That's not a settled thing. And there is another question related. Did India lose its population and have to grow it up again? So yeah, what does this study suggest about what happened?
I'll preface this by saying this is a very controversial question, and this study doesn't put to rest any particular argument on one side or the other. But What the study does find is that for the modern day population that has been sampled and based on ancient genomes from the region that we have, it looks like everyone living in India today derives their ancestry from a group that entered into India around 50,000 years ago, which would have been after the Toba eruption. It doesn't say that there weren't modern humans in India before the eruption, 74 to 80,000 years ago. But what this is suggesting is that as far as we can tell, those people did not contribute to the modern ancestry of Indians living today.
So they might have died out, or their genes might have died out. We don't know.
Exactly. We don't know. And I'll also say that I have talked to some other experts who say that that could be an artifact of low sampling of ancient genomes in the region. So it could be the case that as we find more ancient genomes, that you could detect the signal of more ancient ancestry. But we don't have clear evidence of that yet, and it's not supported by what you see in this most recent paper.
Is there any archaeological record of people in India earlier than?
There is an archaeological record. There are stone tools that have been found at this site called Daba in central India that look an awful lot like what people would have been making, modern humans, but there are other people who argue that they could have been Neanderthal made, that they could have been made by other archaic hominins. There's no clear, distinctive evidence that these were made by modern humans, made by our own species, though you will find people who will tell you that there is clear evidence. And some of the most knockdown, drag-out fights in archaeology are over whether or not you can tell who made what. So I'm not going to step into that argument. I'll let them fight it out in the journals.
You got to keep your neutrality.
I've got to keep my neutrality here. I've got to keep my invitations to conferences.
Well, Mike, is there anything else we could learn if more ancient genomes from this region were uncovered? Is there anything else that we would love to be able to solve about South Asia, you know, if we could have access to that information?
You know, there are further questions to be answered about really pinning down exactly where the, let's say, the Yamnaya steppe ancestry entered into. I mean, we know approximately who these people were, but pinpointing the archaeological sites and specific regions where they would have come from would be interesting to learn. And then beyond that, I think if we want to know more about where and how and when these Neanderthal genes entered into the population, it's going to require more archaeological work. And so until we have archaeological evidence of Neanderthals in India, which we don't have for now, it will remain an open question of whether or not the Neanderthal genes in the Indian population were present to begin with. They might have been there with the settlers that came into India. They might have had earlier interminglings with Neanderthals and brought that with them. Or it's possible that they encountered Neanderthals somewhere on the subcontinent and there was a new pulse of gene flow from relations there, but we don't know. And it's pretty speculative to say whether or not that was the case. But that is one possibility that this study raises, is that one potential explanation for why you see this just sheer diversity of Neanderthal genes in this population is maybe they met a genetically diverse population of Neanderthals who was living there. But I will reiterate, pure speculation. There's no archaeological evidence of Neanderthals in India. And so until they find that, then it remains purely a guess.
Is it just hard to find Neanderthal sites? Or is there like a special set of conditions that preserve them and they're just not present where we want to know more?
The conditions in South Asia aren't as favorable to preserving fossils as they are throughout most of Europe. So that just makes it a lot harder to find them if they are there in the first place.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been really fun talking.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Sarah.
Mike Price is an online news editor for Science. You can find a link to the story we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for a chat with producer Kevin McLean and researcher Matthew Tierney about the role of vitamin A in stem cell plasticity. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today.
Stem cells help maintain healthy tissues, regenerating new cells that serve the same purpose as their predecessors. But when tissues get damaged, stem cells can adjust their function to produce cells that help with repair. This is particularly important for the skin, which has to deal with cuts and scrapes and sunburns all the time. Understanding the mechanisms that regulate and change the fates of stem cells has a lot of potentially important implications from wound care to cancer treatment. Matt Tierney and colleagues studied the effect of vitamin A on stem cells and tissue regeneration in the skin. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the Science Podcast.
Hi, Kevin. Great to be here.
So we're talking about stem cells today, specifically about this process where they can shift from one developmental pathway to another, something called lineage plasticity, which was definitely a new term for me. Can you talk a little bit more about what that is and what you are aiming to study with this work?
Yeah, absolutely. So lineage plasticity is a crucial feature of the stress response in tissues, particularly following disruption of their local environment or niche. In our setting in the skin, we've defined it as when molecular features of their new and original lineages become co-expressed. And this helps grant stem cells the unusual flexibility to choose either fate during the tissue repair process. There's still a lot we don't know about the signals that control lineage plasticity and help distinguish its involvement in pro-regenerative versus degenerative states. And so here we set out to identify its critical regulators in the skin.
Okay, so you wanted to figure out what was controlling these stem cells' ability to shift from making one kind of cell to another when there's damage or something like that. So I definitely want to get into how you go about doing that. But first, why is this such an important phase or phenomenon to study?
Yeah, absolutely. The onset and the resolution of lineage plasticity acts sort of as a double-edged sword in the context of regeneration. So it's necessary to redirect stem cells to the different parts of the tissue that are most in need, but it also leaves those same tissues vulnerable to perpetual states of repair and even some types of cancer if lineage plasticity isn't properly resolved.
So switching into this state of lineage plasticity is good to repair damage, but if they stay in that repair mode, that can also cause problems?
Exactly. A perpetual state of lineage plasticity has been associated with both non-healing wounds and types of cancers, including in the skin.
Okay, so that's why it's important to understand not only how to enter lineage plasticity, but also how they switch back or resolve?
Yes, exactly. So without getting ahead of ourselves, we found that there's a particular signal that is anti-correlated with lineage plasticity. And so its loss from those particular regions of the skin, in this case, the hair follicle, as its niche is disrupted in the context of wound repair, ends up reducing the overall availability of this signal during the wound repair process. And it allows lineage plasticity to be upregulated. But then after the wound has begun to repair itself, that signal comes back on. Once that signal is restored, lineage plasticity is resolved.
Why is the skin such a good place to be studying all of this?
The skin is a really excellent model system for these types of questions, being a barrier tissue that's constantly exposed to environmental insults, and also that contains several discrete stem cell populations, each normally insulated in their own compartments, including the epidermis, the hair follicle, the sebaceous gland, etc., but then can be released from those constraints by a wound and enter the state of lineage plasticity.
So stem cells that are in each of those different compartments could potentially be recruited to act in wound repair if needed?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the manuscript, we use a relatively understudied shallow abrasion wound model that mimics everyday scrapes and scratches, which removes just this top layer of the skin. And so you can consider it almost to be sort of a brush burn or a rug burn or what have you. So it removes just that skin layer, and if done properly, leaves the stem cells of the hair follicle within the dermal layer intact and allows those stem cells to essentially have a choice at this point. They can either remain in the stem cell niche of the hair follicle, contribute to cyclic rounds of hair regrowth, or they can be mobilized upwards to the skin and repair that epidermal barrier.
How do you start looking at what the controls and regulators are in this process? How do you utilize this model to understand that?
Trying to assess this in vivo, in our situation, our work was done in mice, is quite laborious. And so we had an initial point of leverage that came from two prior studies in our lab, together showing that the molecular signatures of lineage plasticity were recapitulated when skin stem cells were placed in traditional cultures. So this set up a much more accessible and tractable system for us to try to model and manipulate the signature. And so we adopted a high throughput screening approach and identified several important signals, including retinoic acid as a vitamin A metabolite, that ended up being essential to resolving lineage plasticity and returning stem cells to their original physiological identity.
Just looking back through, I think I saw there were more than like 70 compounds you were testing. Were you putting all these through sort of battery of tests or watching what that process was? How did that process go?
We understand the molecular signature of lineage plasticity in the skin to be the co-expression of two normally lineage-restricted transcription factors, SOX9 and KLF5. In the context of a hair follicle stem cell, which is normally marked by SOX9, when placed in culture, we know that it will also turn on KLF5 and co-express these two transcription factors together. And so we simply read out, using a fluorescent reporter system, levels of KLF5 and attempted to lower those levels such that SOX9 remained the only transcription factor expressed.
Sorry, walk me back through that last bit again. Normally one or the other expressed, but when are they both expressed?
In healthy skin, SOX9 and KLF5 act antagonistically toward each other, but in the context of a wound repair, they enter into an environmental circumstance that allows both to be co-expressed. And that is because ultimately that now we know that there are certain signals that enable this.
Okay, so which one goes with which again?
Yeah, so SOX9 is canonically a marker of hair follicle stem cells and KLF5 a marker of epidermal stem cells. Under normal conditions, when co-expressed, this is a marker of lineage plasticity, indicating that those cells can become either fate when one or the other eventually is repressed.
All right, so you see both expressed, that's your signal to know that they're in a state of lineage plasticity. And then when they're not in this repair state anymore, they go back to just expressing one or the other?
Yes, once the wound repair process is completed, those transcription factors again label their unique compartments within the skin, lineage plasticity is resolved.
Okay, so let's get back to the compounds you're testing. Retinoic acid came up as something that was important. Is retinoic acid, is it the same as vitamin A or retinol?
Absolutely. We use vitamin A and retinol interchangeably, retinol or vitamin A being the dietarily received. But retinoic acid is produced locally in various tissues in the body through a series of enzymatic reactions.
So how did you know retinoic acid was an important compound to focus on?
We had identified retinoic acid as one of several key factors in our initial screen as being important for lowering KLF5 levels and resolving lineage plasticity. In the manuscript, we eventually identify retinoic acid as most potent in combination with an inhibitor of protein kinase C as being capable of resolving lineage plasticity when stem cells are placed in culture.
And this was already like a compound that was sort of already in the realm of like tissue and skincare, right?
Sure. So in particularly in the skin, we've long known that retinoic acid or retinol signaling in general is critical for a number of different skin phenotypes. You've probably seen it at your local pharmacy as a possible skin remedy for a number of things.
Yeah.
And there were initial clues that vitamin A or retinoic acid signaling could be important for this concept of lineage plasticity. As we've known for some time, that eliminating the signaling cascade in hair follicle stem cells progressively results in hair loss and the formation of epidermal cysts. But we had not known formally how the signaling cascade interacted with lineage plasticity, or I guess we just hadn't explored this particular line of thinking.
So, okay, so now we know that retinoic acid is something that you're wanting to pay attention to. What happens next to sort of figure out what's going on mechanistically?
We took two different approaches after the identification of retinoic acid. to formally understand whether or not this truly regulated or resolved lineage plasticity. We first wanted to understand if retinoic acid was able to resolve lineage plasticity in culture, we would have expected that these stem cells would have regained their physiological identity as hair follicle cells and would be capable of differentiation. We also tested this as sort of a proof of concept in vivo and in the context of wound repair. So we found that manipulating vitamin A signaling during wound healing when lineage plasticity is high was able to refine stem cell fate switching in the wound bed and rebalance their contribution to different aspects of tissue repair, including either the restoration of the skin barrier or the resumption of normal hair regrowth.
I guess zooming out a little bit, I feel like there's a difference between, you know, what people might think stem cells are or do and what maybe they actually do. Do you come across that? Is there anything like, what do you feel most people misunderstand or don't get about stem cells in sort of a broader sense?
Yeah, I guess said perhaps a different way, it takes a village in order to accomplish the task that stem cells are often credited with. And so while stem cells are obviously critical as the direct cellular contributors to regenerative processes, it often ends up being that there are a series of signals or other cell types that are present during any of these different processes that are essential to direct that process. And it's critical that we understand what those are so that stem cells can function properly and act to pro-regenerative ends instead of engaging in the sort of dysfunction or degenerative circumstances or even potentially cancer that might exist otherwise.
Oh, interesting. So it's sort of like raw materials and needing instructions for them?
Yeah, I don't know if I love the sports analogy, but the coach-player analogy, I think, tends to work at its surface level here.
Wait, what do you mean?
Once you start getting into the sort of actual pathologies that come with a stem cell that goes rogue, it sort of backs off quite a bit. But I tend to think of stem cells as being the actual, as the players in the circumstance endowed with like an incredible ability to athletically act, but in need of direction from a coach in order to collectively engage all players involved and enact, you know, get the most out of their collective potential. It's not the greatest analogy, but
I get what you mean. So what's next? Where do you want to take this research?
So I think with this work, one of the major accomplishments has been defining the minimum requirements needed to form mature hair cell types from stem cells outside the body. And I think this work has the potential to transform the way that we approach the study of hair biology generally, meaning that now we have, in this case, an ability to direct stem cells to their differentiated lineages in isolation. This enables us to much more accessibly and tractably pursue aspects of their biology that are much more difficult to study in their in vivo context. I also think therapeutically, there are a number of potential applications to test treatments against these new targets in conditions like non-healing wounds and cancer, when lineage plasticity becomes dysregulated and is often left chronically active in the skin. Both retinoic acid, but also some of the downstream targets that I think we've identified in this manuscript represent potential therapeutic avenues towards affecting different degenerative circumstances.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Matt. It was really nice talking to you.
Appreciate it, Kevin. Thanks for taking the time.
Matt Tierney is a postdoctoral fellow at Rockefeller University. You can find a link to the paper we discussed at science.org/podcasts.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. To find us on podcasting apps, search for Science Magazine. Or you can listen on our website, science.org/podcast. The show was edited by me, Sarah Crespi, and Kevin McLean, with production help from Megan Tuck at Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.